Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr. And before I get started with my guest tonight, I have something. You know, I don't talk about, promote things very much unless I really believe in it. There's a conference September 23rd to 25th in New York City called Micronutrients and Mental Health. And by George, this is a good conference. You ought to look at it if anybody has addictions or depression or fatigue problems or bipolar issues. It's www.mmhforum.org, and I'm probably going to be there, so if you're listening and you go to that conference, you'll see me, and you can find it at mmhforum.org. And my guest tonight is Joe Gatens, and I recently moved up into the North Shore of the Mountains, and he lives up here near where I live, and I met him, and he's a world of information regarding gardening and growing food and sustainable living and organics. So I thought I'd get him to come on my show and tell us a little bit how to better raise our food and raise it healthier for our families. How are you, Joe?
Well, I'm doing fine. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about one of my favorite topics.
Well, I tell you what, I realized that I don't know anything. I knew there was a lot I didn't know, but that now after looking at all this material you gave me, there's so much more that I didn't know that I know that I didn't know now. Does that make sense?
Well, you know, it does make sense.
Didn't know to the 10th power.
Essentially, growing stuff in the dirt and making it come alive is a pretty cosmic thing. It's both science and art, I have found, and a little bit of luck. And we can talk about this probably for a couple of days if we had the time. But
yeah.
Why don't you start off with a few questions? If you want, I'll tell you a little bit about how I got into this this avocation.
Well, I'd like for people to know where they can find you if they have.
Where can they find me? Well, they can find me in the mountains of North Georgia every Saturday between May and the end of October. At the Simply Homegrown Farmers Market in Clayton, Georgia, 9 a.m. to noon, roughly, at 837 Highway 76 West. And if you want to look us up on the internet, it's www.simplyhomegrown.org.
I almost don't even want to name the city. If people saw how beautiful this place is where we live, we'd be bombarded with people, Joe. You know,
this
here.
Is a. This is a really small county tucked away in the northeast Georgia mountains, right where North Carolina and South Carolina bump into Georgia. It's better than 60% national forest, very hilly, very mountainous, and has a rich natural history going back to Mississippian culture days, if you really want to dig that far. A lot of people talk about the first Europeans and the Cherokee bumping into each other, but there was culture here before then, I'm pretty sure. And a lot of it had to do with finding a place to grow corn and grow squash in the valleys, in between the hillsides and the gullies.
So how did you start doing what you're doing? You've not always done this.
Well, I had a career in business for about 25 years up in Virginia, but grew up in Georgia and managed to retire here early about 15 years ago. Essentially, by trial and error, my wife and I have been gardening, both vegetables and flowers, but in my case, mostly vegetables, going back to the late 1970s. Basically, backyard gardening is what I would call it, and it was pretty basic stuff. And I'm not sure we always knew what we were doing, but I've made every mistake in the book, and now that I've learned what the mistakes are, I'm trying to avoid them and do a little bit better every year. In time, this would be the best advice I could give to any of your listeners, is to start small and don't be afraid to make mistakes. But we're going to try to avoid making mistakes tonight as we go along.
Other than what you just said, start small, what is your top suggestion if somebody said, if you can tell me one thing, what would be your top suggestion for a first-time grower?
Well, you need to have dirt, and the dirt has to be located in a place that's sunny enough to grow crops through photosynthesis, and in most cases that means 8 hours of sun per day over a several-month period. If you're above the Arctic Circle, that's a very tight window. If you're lower down in the lower 48, you can probably start growing in many cases from mid-March all the way till the beginning of November, and maybe even extend it beyond that. So you got to have dirt, you got to have sun, and you have to have water. And it has to be eventually fertile dirt, and we're going to talk about how to get it more fertile as time goes on. But those are the three key things that you've got to have if you want to grow your own produce.
Now let me ask you this. If you have a grow room, like I have a little shed, and we put insulation in it, and we put it had grow lights, and it actually came with this property. Can we start seeds in that room, or can we grow anything in that room?
Well, you can probably start seeds, and a lot of people do start seeds inside early in February, early in January sometimes, with a little heat pad underneath and the grow lamp on top of it. But I cannot tell you if this would end up putting up a 6-foot-tall tomato. I really don't know because I've never done that. I've always planted outside. But indoor grow lights and water and little heating pads are used by gardeners all the time to start seedlings.
Now, one thing someone told me I wanted to ask you about was, you know how you can get those cardboard egg cartons when you buy organic eggs at the store?
Yeah, you can, and you've got to fill them with some potting soil and then pray that you've got enough sunlight, enough water, enough heat to let the seedlings pop out and that they don't go bad on you. I don't have much success doing that. I usually try to field grow most of my seeds or most of my plants once it gets warm enough.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about soil. Do you recommend using bagged soil? Because that's our first thing is getting some soil.
This would be right up there along with having enough water, sun, and dirt. You probably need to find out what the chemical composition of your dirt is. And in every county, in every state of the United States, there is something under the county government called the County Extension Office. And you go to these people and say, I need the little envelope to give you a soil sample so you can tell me if my dirt will grow vegetables or flowers. And they'll send it off to the university, usually the land-grant university for that state, and bring you back in about a week or 10 days, if they're not all backed up, a soil test report that basically will tell you what you need to add to your soil, if anything. Now, what do I mean by adding to the soil? There are three components that are pretty key and several others, but the real key ones are nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, NPK, and they will do a chemical analysis of your soil and tell you whether you need to add any of these ingredients. They'll also, as part of the same report, and usually it's fairly affordable. In Georgia, currently it's $9 for each sample. We'll tell you if you need calcium or limestone added to your soil, as well as some of the smaller but crucial other ingredients that go into soil, calcium, magnesium, zinc, and so forth. So that's a really key thing to do because between the nitrogen requirements and the potassium and the phosphorus requirements and especially the lime requirements, your soil has got to be in balance, and that's a measure of pH, usually on the pH scale of between 6.0 and 6.5. And if you go too high, stuff won't grow as well, and if you go too low, it won't grow either. So you need to be in that sort of sweet spot range. And this is the way to find out if you're there or not.
One thing that I learned this year, I went to Home Depot and bought bags of topsoil. Nothing grew. So I tested it. There was nothing in that soil. So do you recommend people buying topsoil and then amending it, or do you recommend people buying the bags of soil that have stuff put in it?
Well, what I would suggest is starting off fairly slowly. if you can't see what the chemical composition is of the topsoil you're buying, I wouldn't buy it. But you can buy some ingredients that will help generally improve soil. And if you do any kind of basic reading, basic gardening books, there are three or four items that you can buy commercially that are worth adding to a garden bed. One is composted cow manure or composted or fertilizer of some sort, but basically you're adding organic matter if you've got composted cow manure. Peat moss to help aerate the soil. And then depending on whether the soil is sandy or clay, some sand or some vermiculite to be added to the soil. And that usually will help it at least at a starter level. Once you get something growing there and you survive a season or two, I would definitely urge people to get into composting and use compost as a soil amendment.
Okay, we're going to get into that too. What about potash? That when I moved up here to the mountains, all the farmers said you need to get some potash. What is that and what does it do?
Well, it's basically the ingredient in the NPK, in the potassium, and basically you can buy that as a commercial additive to your soil in various combinations.
Is that an organic thing or inorganic?
Well, if you're going to get into organic, you're going into something that'll probably take three radio shows to explain. But the quick answer is that potassium is not necessarily organic under the National Organic Program, but some of it probably is, depending on whether it's been approved by the federal government and is on a federal approved list for ingredients that can be used in organic by organic growers.
How would you put potassium in the soil then?
Well, essentially, my soil sort of basically tested out pretty good here. So I came back with a test that shows I have enough potassium, enough phosphorus, enough calcium, and maybe probably enough lime to grow through the next couple of seasons. Okay. A lot of times it will be part of the soil, particularly if it hasn't been used as a garden for a while. If you've if it's been like a grassy spot and you remove the grass, the soil underneath may be pretty good already.
Now, one thing that I learned from you, and I couldn't believe that I did this. I should have had enough sense. Was first thing I did, because my property, you've seen my property, and I have a big property, but it's not ready to be gardened yet. So I went out and bought four railroad ties and made me a little square of a garden. And first thing you said to me was, don't buy railroad ties because it leaches chemicals. So
well, the reason you don't buy railroad ties or pressure-treated wood, whether you're organic or not, is that there are chemicals in these treated woods that leach into the soil. And creosote, I'm not sure, is a basic ingredient of good soil. As for the pressure-treated, I think there's I'm really not sure what goes into pressure-treated wood, but I've been told from an organic point of view you don't want to use that either.
So
if you're going to build a box, use raw wood. Or untreated wood, or don't use anything at all. Just build it up by digging a trench around the edges of the bed.
Now, tell a little bit more about that, because that's what you do, so explain that so people can get what you mean.
All right. Think in terms of of starting small. Think in terms of a bed that's 4 foot wide and no more than 8 foot long. Once you've dug this up and gotten rid of the grass that's on top and the weeds that are on top, you take a spade or a shovel and basically remove the edges and put the edges back on top, which will automatically raise the bed by usually about 3 or 4 inches. So you have a small little trench around the edges of this 4x8 bed, and to make sure they don't wash away at the next rainstorm, you tamp them down with a rake, and the edges usually hold unless you really have a big hurricane.
Okay. So another question that I have is, when I go to Ace or Home Depot or some store and I ask for some fertilizer for my soil, they walk me over to their fertilizer and give me a bag of some kind of chemical to put on my fertilizer.
And most of the time, the commercial fertilizers are 10-10-10. That's 10% nitrogen, 10% potassium, 10% phosphorus, or some measure thereof. And that's how you can tell what the ingredients are in this commercial fertilizer, which is most often petroleum-based if it's a commercial fertilizer. What I end up using, and if any of your listeners are living in the country, and most of them probably are, many of them probably are, find your nearest horse barn and start moving their horse manure to your site and compost it, and then use that on your garden for nitrogen.
So how does one convert an inorganic fertilizer into an organic one? How do you figure that out?
Well, again, you go to this approved organic list. There are some granular; they look exactly like commercial fertilizer, but they've been approved by the government because they're usually based on bat guano or seaweed or fish food, and have been turned into a fertilizer that the government will approve as organic. There are many commercial manipulations that won't work, and you're not going to find them on the list. So essentially, you've got to do some homework before you go down to your local feed and seed store and buy the first bag of fertilizer that you see on the rack.
Okay. It's fall now. Everybody's pretty much gotten all their summer crops up. What should we be planting now?
Fall vegetables. I've got a lot of winter squashes coming in that basically got planted here in the past 2 to 3 weeks. Your greens will end up doing very, very well right now. This is everything from the brassicas, like probably late broccoli, kale, collards, mustard greens, some of the Asian greens, tatsoi, and so forth, will come up very well and survive well into the frost period, into November, at least down here in the South.
Okay. Any root vegetables?
Carrots. Okay. Root vegetables are. This is also the time to plant your leeks and your onions and your garlic for harvest in the spring. The rule of thumb for garlics in particular is to plant them, at least in this part of Georgia, no later than Halloween. They'll pop up by about 4 or 5 inches between then and the first frost. And just as the first frost is hitting, you mulch it real heavily, mulch your garlic beds real heavily, so they don't heave up in the frost. And then come February, sometimes late January, they'll start popping up through the mulch and make you a really nice garlic harvest in early May or mid-May to June.
That's great to know. So after we get our fall crop, what should we do to our soil after the fall growing season is over to get it ready for spring, talking about cover crops and mulching and things like that?
Go to your favorite seed catalog and look at the back of the book. There's usually a whole list of cover crops. Not all of them grow in the winter, but there is winter rye, there is winter wheat, and you can plant those, and they will be a good additive to the soil by next spring when you incorporate it into the soil. And then when you pop up in the spring, you can use hairy vetch and legume vegetables as a cover crop as well.
Why do we want to use cover crops?
Did I miss a question there?
Oh, sorry. Why would we even want to use cover crops?
It's essentially a green manure. It adds nitrogen to the soil. It aerates the soil. And believe me, it's sort of a rule of thumb. This is not how they put it in the gardening books, but it's sort of a homegrown rule. If you take something out and harvest, it makes sense to put something back in the soil to help the amendments and to help the soil for the next season.
And
so basically, you're adding fertility to the soil when you add in a cover crop.
Do you till it in?
Some people till it in. Some people just layer it on top and then keep layers going. I think the term is a lasagna garden. You can find books about that. I till mine in,
okay,
rather than have them pop out as additional weed-looking things around my plants.
So,
but you can do it either way.
You were talking about using manure. Are
right.
there certain kinds of manure that we should use? Can we take it right out of the barn and put it on there? How do we use manure? Which one is choice over another?
Raw manure is probably not a good thing to put right around your tomato plants or anything that's growing right then. But you can apply barely or fairly new manure like right now and let it compost itself into the spring. And then when your early spring vegetables are planted, you'd be all right. The basic rule of thumb, and this is coming out of the organic rules, is that you need to compost manure for 6 months before applying it for root vegetables, and I'm sorry, for vegetables above ground, and 9 months if it's going to be a root vegetable. So composting it is the key phrase. I would avoid raw manure. You can harvest it then and put it in a compost pile, but I would let it work itself down before applying it to the garden.
Now, is that
but
for
it's a pretty
all
wonderful
manure?
Additive to soil, I've found.
I know that chickens are too hot, but someone told me that you could use goat and rabbit manure kind of fairly soon. Is that true?
I would not do it fairly soon. I would follow basically the rule, the 6 month or the 9 month rule.
Okay.
To let it compost so it basically is not hot and raw anymore, and I think you'll be all right. I've used cow manure, horse manure, goat manure, and maybe at one time some chicken manure, but chicken manure is something that you need to think about depending on how clean and green you want your garden to be. Some of the science recently has found that chicken manure basically coming out of chicken houses not only has all sorts of chemicals in it, but also a bunch of drug additives that are fed to the chickens, hormones and such, and I'm not sure that gets killed in the composting process, or at least so the science suggests. So you need to know where you're getting your chicken manure, whether it's your neighbor's backyard who's got 15 chickens, or if it's a big chicken house where it's grown commercially.
How is that different from cow manure? Don't they give all that stuff to cows?
Well, I don't think they do quite as much, at least in Georgia, in this industry. I don't think, if I understand correctly, that they're allowed to. But it's a matter of sourcing your manure. If you're going to a big commercial operation, chances are those cows and the animals are being fed all sorts of chemicals as part of their feed. Whereas if it's your neighbor who's milking two cows, then you need to just talk to him and find out what he's doing or what she's doing.
Okay. My next question is, are there any variables that we should know about requirements for root vegetables versus green versus above-ground vegetables? Some plants like fertilizer just before planting. Others like it the previous year. And by the previous year, do you mean the previous fall, or does it mean a year prior, 12 months prior?
You're talking about whether I should plant the same vegetable in the same bed every year? Is that what you're asking?
Well,
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I'm going to make a bold statement.
Okay.
Which is as follows. It makes a lot of sense to basically rotate your crops from bed to bed, from year to year. If you've got a bean bed, make that next year the tomato bed, and vice versa, so that whatever bad things occurred on that bed that year will not be transmitted and work on the same vegetable the next year, particularly if you've had any kind of bug infestation.
Mm. I had a funny thing this year. Did I show you those things that happened to my tomatoes where my leaves all wadded up and got sick?
Yeah, I think you showed those to me, and I didn't know what they were, but it looked to me like it was some sort of virus or fungus, and there are dozens, if not hundreds, of different viruses and funguses that can attack crops, and they're usually out there. Back in my smoking days, I've reformed since then, but back in my smoking days, I think my tomatoes were picking up something called tobacco mosaic virus just from nicotine on my hands, and the bottom leaves were turning yellow because of that.
Interesting. If your plant gets a fungus, does that mean that the plant has a disease, or does that mean the plant has some nutrient deficiency? Like, I know that when squash get those little white spots, people say it's a fungus, but isn't it really like a calcium deficiency, and you give it calcium and it gets better?
Well, it depends. If it's a fungus, it probably gets blown in or brought in by an animal, and it's not necessarily a soil deficiency unless the fungus is in the soil already and attacking the roots, and that has happened to me in the past. I'm not a fungus expert, So I'm not sure I'm going to weigh in on this, but it's not necessarily a soil deficiency. I have a feeling. Well, let me put it to you this way. 4 years ago, I had something like 80 tomato plants that were looking very, very vigorous and had a lot of fruit on them that was just turning orange and red when something called late blight got a hold of all my tomato plants. And in the space of about 5 days, this black fungus basically ate the tomato plants from the bottom up, all 80 of them, killed them all. And I don't think it was a soil deficiency that year.
Interesting. So do you have any recommendation for seed sources?
I've got some favorite. Basically, people need to do their own research. There are hundreds of seed sources. I'll tell you a couple of my favorites because I have found that the vegetables, that the seeds that they provide work really well right here. Sort of top of the list is a little seed place up in New York State called Turtle Tree Seed that is part of an intentional community, and they basically source their seed from about 20 or so organic or biodynamic farm operations, and their seed is excellent. I mean, basically, it germinates in a hurry. And I've had really good results there. Another one that I like from Mineral, Virginia, also allied with an intentional community called Southern Exposure Seed Exchange. And they're real good for stuff that grows in the Piedmont and Valley of the East Coast going south and also in this little part of Appalachia. You can also put down Abundant Life Seeds, High Mowing Seeds, Peaceful Valley out in Oregon or California, wherever it is. And if you're thinking of getting into commercial seed growing operation, there's a seed outfit up in Maine called Fedco, F-E-D-C-O, that has all sorts of different vegetables.
Now, when people talk about organic versus all natural, organic, is that just merely getting a piece of paper? Can you do it all natural and still be considered organic just by yourself? Does that make sense?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about that with various farmers. Essentially, the way or the status of the organic movement or the organic requirements currently is that if you want your operation to be organic, you have to subscribe to a federal law administered by the states called the National Organic Program. That is now federal law and has a multiplicity of different rules for what you need to do to be able to market and sell your produce or your seeds as organic. If you're going to do it the organic way without going through the paperwork and the licensing requirements of the federal government, you are technically, under law, not allowed to use the term organic. As
your
I understand
food that,
it.
That the food that you're going to grow is just as good if you do it now.
Well,
natural component.
It's going to be in the eye of the beholder. What I tell people is if it's important to you that it be termed organic, you need to ask me if I'm organic or not. If it's important to you to know that you grew it in an organic fashion but you didn't do all the paperwork, I need to be able to tell you that as well. There's got to be more trust is what I'm coming to between the grower and the consumer. I mean, right now, we go to most grocery stores and have no idea where the produce on the shelves is coming from. Several years ago, there was a move to require a sourcing of food that, if I understand correctly, died in Congress under pressure from the industry. And that's why it makes sense to basically talk to your produce managers or patronize all the little tailgate markets that are growing up all over the place and talk to the people who are actually growing it and ask them, how do you do what you do?
Let's go back to manure. I'm sorry, did you get finished?
No, you go ahead.
That's all right, finished.
I think I have finished,
okay.
At least on that question.
I wanted to go back to manure for a few minutes. What is the difference between raw, fresh and dried, and composted? And why?
Well, I don't know about fresh or dried. That sounds like a commercial sort of thing, but basically, raw is right out of the barn stall. It's wet, pungent, smelly, and probably laced with all sorts of hay and sawdust. If you leave it on a compost pile and turn it every week or so for 6 months, it'll reduce in size. It will heat up. the natural whatever's left in the way of leaves and twigs and hay in there will decompose, and it'll basically come down to a what feels like soil rather than manure. One of them is right out the back of the cow or the horse, and one of them is a soil additive that feels like dirt.
Okay. Are there any types of manures that we should not use from any particular like
I don't know.
Or cats?
You've stumped me. Eva, that's a question I can't answer. I'm sorry. I do not know.
Well, I'll tell you the answer. I know that we shouldn't use dogs and cats or seagulls. I got that out of your book.
Okay. Well, you know more than I do. I need to reread that book. Yeah, dogs and cats doesn't sound like something we want to fool with, does it?
No, it doesn't. So I just wanted people to know that they need to do their homework before they go out and put manure about what they're putting on there. Now, the next question is there any time requirement for using manure prior to harvesting your crop? Let's say you have a garden and it's growing, and you've seeded it, and it's starting to grow up, and it gets time to put more fertilizer on it. So you put the fertilizer on, and then the tomatoes and things or whatever it is starts growing. Is there a
Well, let me tell you what I do. I usually incorporate the manure before I plant the seeds or before I put the seedlings in. And this is manure that's either been composted 6 months or 9 months, like we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. But then once the tomato plants or the squash plant starts coming out, and I think they need a shot of fertilizer or a little bit of addition, I will use a fish meal solution around the edge of the plant and use that instead of more manure or compost. I think compost needs to be applied, at least in my case, it seems to work better if I apply it before planting or transplanting. But fish meal solutions are a good little kicker. Other people like to use what they call manure teas, and there's probably more books about that and more internet stuff about manure teas that I'll let your listeners look up about how you make those and how you apply those.
One thing that I was wondering about was, I got this out of your book. If you use, your book said if you use manure as your plants or as your fruit's harvest is coming out, that you have to wait a certain number of days before you pick it off because you could get, you know, bacteria or something. Is that true? Do we need to worry about that?
There's always a chance, and people are paying much more attention to this. There's always a chance that manure will carry the E. coli bug, which if it gets into your body as a human is not a good thing. There have been all sorts of scares about that in the lettuce fields of California, going back several years. So I would basically avoid putting manure just before harvest.
Okay. Does manure or any other fertilizer for that matter, does it lose any nutritional value if you just put it on top of the soil? Do you have to rub it in?
No, you can do it either way. You can incorporate it or add it at the top. Top dressing either way will eventually work into the soil.
The reason I'm asking that question is because when I was reading this book that you gave me, it said if you just put manure on top of the soil, it loses something like 40% of its nitrogen or something like that within 4 days. Is that true?
Well, if it's in the book, I'm guessing it must be true. But this is the kind of scientific stuff that needs to be reviewed and read about all the time. I've done it both ways. I've put it on top, or I've incorporated it and gotten good results.
I guess it would matter if you got a lot of rain or something. Maybe.
Right.
I don't know. Okay. How does one discourage leaching of soil nutrients throughout the harvest season or the growing season?
Well, one good way to do that is to make sure you don't have an erosion problem, that you're not on a steep slope. If you want to make sure that your nutrients are staying where they need to be, either flat or very, very small slope would be a good thing to do. And also arrange these 4x8 beds so that there's not like a gully going right through the middle of all the 4x8 beds.
Okay. Could you discuss fertilizer imbalances and what I really mean is fertilizer nutrient antagonists. If you got too much of this, you're going to have too little of this. Can you give us some examples? Calcium.
Well, a good example that I'm fighting with right now is that about 3 years ago, instead of putting limestone down on the as a lime addition to my beds because they needed lime, I used hardwood ashes from a stove. And put them fairly liberally on a couple of the beds, and it turned out that I had made the beds too alkali. The lime requirement was way out of kilter, and the pH was way out of balance. It was way too alkali. I'm sorry, way too acid. So I had to back away from that, and the soil test reports suggested using some sort of sulfur additive to basically calm down the lime, and I had to find one of those out of the approved list book.
So now that you brought up lime, I told you I was going to ask this question. What is the difference between calcitic lime and dolomitic lime?
I knew you were going to ask that question, so I quickly went to the internet to try to find out what the difference is. They both have similar ingredients, but dolomitic limestone has magnesium on top of it, and if your beds need magnesium, then you should use dolomitic limestone. If they don't need magnesium, you can use calcitic limestone, and it'll lower the acidity just as well.
So both have a lower acidity.
It's a function of the chemicals that are in the two different types of limestone.
So, how do you test for it? I mean, you test your magnesium levels.
That comes back as part of the soil test from the County Extension Office.
Okay.
So you will have a pretty good feeling for what the pH of your beds are, and you'll have a pretty good feeling as to whether you need limestone or not.
Does lime increase the bacterial activity?
You know, I'm really not sure.
Okay.
I really don't know. What does the book say?
I'll fess up. Your book said that it did.
You are an expert.
Thank God I have
on reading
books.
My books.
Do what?
You're an expert on reading my books.
Hey, that's why I have to have them, because I know nothing about what I'm talking about, you know?
what people need to realize, if I could just digress just for a second, is that if you have three or four of these 4x8 beds, don't be afraid to use slightly different techniques on each and see which one, trial and error, works best. I guess I've been gardening as a backyard gardener fairly seriously since the mid-1980s, and I probably made all sorts of mistakes, but things seem to be getting into balance these days, and some of it, I think, is a bit cosmic. I mean, I'm talking to the plants and patting them on the back verbally for doing what they do. I've been amazed at some of the harvest I've gotten. I'll give you an example. I grew a bed of Asian-type cucumbers called Suyo Long cucumbers this year that started basically fruiting, and I was able to harvest them beginning in late May, and I picked the last one here a week ago. And that's a good run of cucumbers, which doesn't usually happen.
Mm-hmm. And I think I need to say that I keep referring to your book. You have not yet written a book, but...
I have written a book, but not about gardening.
You gave me some books, Building Capacity in Organic Agriculture, from, I guess,
right,
the seminar that you went to, and some other books. So that's where I'm getting all these questions from.
Right.
Another question, and I have to tell you, I got it from this book, that I wanted to talk about was gypsum. What can you tell us about gypsum?
I can't tell you a thing about it on this radio show. I'd have to look it up. I think people think they can use gypsum that's in wallboard and put it into their garden. It'll do stuff, good stuff. I'm not sure that's actually right. I would need to look it up and see what it really does. I've heard a lot of people talk about that and say, okay, gypsum, where do I get it? What does it do? And I'm a blank on that. I would have to do some research.
Well, I'll tell you, since I brought it up, I'll tell you what I found in your book.
Just so
people will know, because it sounded kind of useful, that it's actually calcium sulfate, and it's used to loosen up compacted soils.
Uh-huh.
And that it adds calcium and sulfur and helps soil retain water and decrease soil erosion. I don't understand how it does that.
It sounds like everything I need.
Yeah, that's, well, synchronicities, you know. Maybe that's what you need there. Let's see, the next thing. Now that we're growing lettuces and greens and cabbages, how do we keep the rabbits from eating them? In other words, what do we do for pest control?
Well, for the critters, particularly if you're out in the middle of the mountains like we both live in, the critters are going to be everywhere. Rabbits, raccoons, slow-moving turtles, slow-moving possums, and a lot of deer. And if we really are bad and the stars are aligned against us, the bears and the wild hogs are going to get into your garden. So what I've found is that there are certain vegetables that the animals will not bother too much, and that's the garlics and the leeks. I've got some fairly large garlic beds and leek beds that are not enclosed, and the deer have left them pretty much alone. But everything else has to be enclosed, is what I have found. You can't just leave it out there and. Unless you've got a really big dog that's out there all day and night, you can't leave a garden bed alone because they will find it. So what I've done is I've put up some chicken wire, layered it up with some hog pen fencing, and down at the bottom to keep the rabbits out, I've got a row of 2x10s, three deep, so that they can't go underneath it or go above it. It's a lot of time and effort, but it's worth it because otherwise the animals will get to you. And this is happening more and more in urban areas. I mean, you're getting deer and bear coming down to the suburbs of Atlanta, and they're looking for food.
Yeah, there's no food here, Harley. No rain. I mean, rain's been bad. So I've got two more things I want to talk about, and that's the almanac.
Sure. And I think we have enough time.
We only got 15 minutes.
Okay.
I also wanted to try to talk a few minutes about our community garden, tell people how to do that. But I have one more question about the pest control, and that's I was at our little community garden the other day, and I heard these two women having a conversation about using their husband's urine and spreading around the outside of their garden that the animals would smell that as a domain thing. Is that something we can do?
That is something you can do. Now, whether it works or not is something else, but this is mountain lore is the best way to describe it. I've heard a lot of people say that, and, no harm, no foul. If you put it outside the garden, it's not going to hurt anything.
And the other thing was another friend of mine takes bars of ivory soap and cuts them in half and puts them on sticks and sticks them around. Does that help?
I've tried that. I'm not sure it does.
Okay.
But there is literature that suggests they are repelled by perfumes and soap, and I'm not sure that really works. There are also commercial sprays that you can put on on the edges of your garden, and I'll describe one that I've used, and it seems to work up to a point, but it's not necessarily a panacea, and that's something called Deer Stopper that you can find in the catalogs, that is a mixture of thyme oil, rosemary oil and essence of rotten eggs, and then a whole bunch of additives that basically turn it into a slurry that you can spray out on your fence post. Do these things work? I don't think they work as well as a good strong fence.
Okay.
But that's just me.
Well, for my listeners, I know I interviewed a man a few years ago. His name is Andy Lopez. And I think the name of his book was Invisible Gardener. But if you look up Andy Lopez, he's written a really good book on organic pest control. And So if you have some questions, you might want to look there just for my listening audience. Now, do you want to talk about, it's 8:47, we've got till 9 o'clock. Do you want to talk about the Farmer's Almanac, or do you want to talk about our community garden and our canning?
Well,
garden?
I'll do both.
Okay.
When you're talking about the Farmer's Almanac or the moon books or the moon calendars, I have found that there's a multiplicity of both sources on the Internet and also printed material that will give you a guide as to how to plant and harvest vegetables by the signs of the moon. And I think you have to use these with a bit of common sense. You have to have good soil fertility. You have to have good soil. You have to have water. You have to have aeration. You have to basically have a decent garden. But what I have found from experience is if I plant under the right sign of the moon for the right kind of vegetable that day, it will germinate faster, and it will grow vigorously. And do I swear by it? Well, the proof's in the pudding. I put in a couple of rows of arugula seed here under the right sign of the moon here about 3 weeks ago, and they germinated in 2 days, which is very, very quick for this area. So I'm pleased by it, and I think it's a good thing to do if it works, and people need to try it to see how they do it. As for the commercial aspects of this business, say we've got a bumper crop of zucchini, which is pretty easy to do, or a bumper crop of cucumbers, every locale in the country has farmers markets of some sort, and there more and more of them are popping up all over the place. In this area, we have two. One of them has been in existence 10 years, working on the 11th, called the Simply Homegrown Market at simplyhomegrown.org, and it operates basically for local people within a confined area, this county and adjacent counties, so then the produce doesn't come in from Chile or California or Florida. And for those who don't want to come into town on Saturdays, there's a fairly new model for this kind of market called the Internet Market, where customers can go on a website and order their produce on a Monday. I harvest it on Tuesday, drop it off at a pickup location on Wednesday, and get paid the same day. This is basically working very well in Georgia in about five different localities: Conyers, Atlanta, Athens, Georgia, and now Clayton and Clarksville, Georgia, here in the northeast Georgia mountains.
So I'd like to also talk about our little
our community garden
down there by the school. So people,
sure, and you're the newest member of it.
I am. I'm so excited.
This is a group called the Sustainable Mountain Living Communities nonprofit that basically decided 2 years ago to try to jumpstart a small community garden plot on school property, or actually county property, in the middle of the county seat, Clayton, Georgia. And I think they had about 15 different growers on what looks to me like about a quarter acre of land last year, and it sort of blossomed this year where they've got 60 plots, 5 foot wide, 20 foot long, being worked by better than 40 different people, most of whom, from the looks of it, are having a very successful season. Most of this food is either being distributed locally to food banks or to people in need, as well as home use, and it's turned into a very successful enterprise that is, I'm pretty sure, going to be able to jumpstart and reincorporate a public cannery and commercial kitchen here in this area.
Now, if another community wanted to talk to somebody about learning how to start that, is there somebody here where
they
ought
to talk to the Sustainable Mountain Living Community people? The best thing to do would be to contact you, and then we'd do an email thing, introduce them to the people who are in charge of that.
I was looking at the list the other day. I mean, there have been hundreds of pounds of food donated to homeless. I mean, you know, we had the tornado that came through here and ripped up everything.
Right.
Not too long ago. There's been hundreds of pounds of food donated from this simple little. How big is that garden there?
Well, if I understand correctly, and I'd have to go back and look it up, but I think they have 60 plots that are each 5 foot wide, 20 foot long, with a path right through the middle of it. And then at the other end, they've got a bee operation, so we'll get good pollination. They've got a beehive, and they have another little area specifically reserved for growing corn, that's separate and apart from everything else. And from the looks of it, people have put in okra, tomatoes, squash, potatoes, and a lot of flowers. And it seems to me that it's a very successful operation just from what they've been able to grow this year.
And I'll tell you something that I've found important is these people have come together as a group. And it's a team effort. They're working with
that's true.
Is it our
they have
city
a,
officials or the county officials, whoever it is. I don't even know.
They have a every other week, every 2 weeks, they have a sort of gardening course that basically is very well attended. Usually between 30 and 50 people show up. This is everything from how do you make your own manure tea, how do you save your own seed, what's the best time to plant your spring vegetables, what's the best time and process for planting your fall crops. I'm giving a course here. The last course of the year is going to be how to properly plant garlic in the fall, and that's on October 3.
And another thing that I've just found phenomenal is I don't know who the people got with. Was it a city or a county?
Basically, this is I'm trying to think.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I think it's county property in this case, but it's right in the middle of the city, and the city provides the water.
So the government officials are cooperating with these people. They've given them the water. They've given them the land. People have come and dumped truckloads of composted manure. Somebody's built a little shed, and there's every single tool that you need to do this to do your gardening.
That's right.
Inside this tool house. So somebody donates the seeds. The local schools, Future Farmers of America, the students start germinating the seeds and then give them out to you. People donate the seeds for the students to do that. So everything doesn't cost anybody anything. It costs $10 a year.
Well, it's a model that can be duplicated everywhere. And frankly, it's a model that's worth thinking about from a we haven't talked about this, but I throw it in every time I talk about gardening. I think there's a need to be aware of our food security. Right now, the food is transported hundreds, if not thousands of miles, in most cases, to get to your local grocery stores. And we don't know exactly how they grew it, where they grew it, or where it came from. And there may come a time when that sort of transport is more difficult looking further out. So going back to the old idea of a victory garden or a local garden makes eminent good sense in these uncertain times, I think.
I do, too. Well, our time's up, Joe. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on my show tonight.
Well, Eva, I hope I didn't bore anybody.
I don't think so.
It was my pleasure. we can do this anytime you want. We can probably talk about this for many more times, but thank you again for giving me the opportunity.
Thanks much, and I'll get your stuff back to you soon.
Okay.
Good
thank
night.
You, Eva.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health. Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Hare.